The beginning of the most famous radio play ever broadcast sets the stage for a drama that would go far beyond the confines of a New York studio on that night of October 30th, 1938. The Mercury Theater production of War of the Worlds, with its simulated Martian attack, would become the stuff of legend. How did Orson Welles make his Martian invasion so convincing on radio? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Why was the original story by H.G. Wells so popular? What was Orson Welles trying to accomplish with his radio version of it? And what did he think about the reaction to it? Our guest is Tim Troy, Chair and Professor of Theater Arts at Lawrence University.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Hi, thanks for having me here.
Before we talk about the famous radio broadcast of The War of the Worlds, tell us about that story by H.G. Wells and just how, I guess, popular and well-known it was before the broadcast.
Wells' story comes out in 1898. So by the time we're hitting 1937, we're a couple generations later, and it's entered the popular culture to a large degree. There are comic book treatments of it. There are sequels, authorized or not authorized, that continue the story and continue, you know, explorations of what that civilization would be like, that also explore space travel and time travel and other sorts of how modernity is being brought to us from another place rather than what we're creating ourselves. And that those would be a lot of the themes that were being explored that people talked about from the original. Another thing to note about the original is that Wells set it in a real place in England, in a contemporaneous context. So the Wells hoped that there was a certain veracity to the story, that our imaginations would be piqued to think that this actually happened, because that's a real place and I could take a train there. And I think that impulse is something that Wells, Orson Welles.
I was just thinking how Wells,
Wells
confusing
me,
all
Wells
these Wells are. But we have H.G. Wells, the 19th century author. Then we have Orson Welles, the actor and adapter, stage director, all that. They did overlap a little bit, too. It must have been quite an amusing thing for Wells and Wells to get together on this. With the original science fiction by H.G. Wells and so on, what is it about that story that you think lent itself to a radio broadcast?
Or
a radio adaptation?
Sure. I think, well, Orson Welles was especially brilliant at radio drama, at taking a new medium, the broadcast medium, the auditory medium, and creating stories that were vivid. And he had so much experience with it by this time. He had run for years in the Shadow, which, you know, is really corny to us now, but very effective and was a very familiar voice. Of course, he was making a lot of theater. This was following his work with the Works Progress Administration Federal Theater Project during the Depression. Was internationally known in England, especially spent some time in Ireland at the Abbey and the Gate Theaters in Dublin as well. So he's really a top-notch storyteller.
At the age of 23.
Remarkably young. I mean, he's a savant in that regard. And I think what he did really well was take a story that was already well-known and give it a new skin, and that skin being radio broadcast, of matching H.G. Wells' sensibilities about a kind of veracity, this could happen down the road, maybe this already happened and you don't know yet, all those kind of great melodramatic questions a story like that can raise, and place it in a time and with a medium, radio, that he really had a lot of command over, remarkable command and currency, so that the radio adaptation that comes out is so vivid, and we'll get to this some more later, that people think it's actually happening, that they completely lose the frame. And I think that's something that we can continue to talk about through the hour.
What had they done previously? Now, this is part of the Mercury Theater, which Orson Welles has this kind of dream cast of people working with him on in terms of the music and the writers and the actors. What had they done before for Mercury Theater?
Well, I know that just prior to this, they had done an adaptation of Dracula. So his ability to work in a melodramatic medium that seemed realistic, kind of mixing verite and over-the-top fantasy and blurring the line between fantasy and, you know, news reportage was something that he had worked on and was successful at prior to this. Another thing to think about with Mercury Theater on the Air is that there was also a Mercury Theater that was a theater, you know, where people paid tickets and went at 8 o'clock and the lights went down and you saw famous actors on stage and they knew it was theater. And he was working with some of the best people in the business. So he's another example of someone who really wasn't pulling it up from the bottom. He was really creaming off the top with the best talent, with the best techniques, the best technology available to him. And a lot of that had to do with the kind of prestige that he already possessed in full force by the time we hit October of 38.
Do you have a sense of what his relationship with CBS was at this point? I mean, here he's this reputation of this wunderkind and this guy who's experimental and pushing the envelope. How did CBS feel about that?
My sense is that, like a lot of Wells's career, he was both adored and people were frightened of him at the same time. They had a sense that he was going to break a boundary. Yeah, if you gave him a limit, you know, if you gave him a leash that was seven feet long, he would, you know, try to get to 7'5" right away. So I'm sure that was going on. Very famous program director William Paley at the time was known as being alternatively, you know, arbitrary with people and firing them and also bringing on brilliant new people and starting new kinds of programming. So it was a very vital place. And it was also a network that was willing to experiment, that was willing to do narrative radio drama that other networks weren't doing in the same way. So it would have been a fertile place for someone like Wells. And I think at the same time, you know, you can imagine the people at CBS were always watching him closely to see. Yeah, a little nervous to see what he was going to come up with.
And, you know, he obviously sort of intended this to be around Halloween, mm-hmm. you know, where you're supposed to be scared and so on. Do we know, going into it, whether he intended some of the reaction that would happen, whether it was designed, in fact, mm-hmm. to scare people into panic?
My sense is that there is no way he could have known what kind of response this was going to get. And I base that on a couple of things. One, he's using a medium that is new, and he's using techniques within the context of the adaptation that are only a couple of years old. For instance, the live reporting from a scene of a disaster, we think of the Hindenburg, and that had happened just 18 months prior to this, roughly. And even people that don't know the history of radio broadcasting or broadcasting much probably have in their ear, oh, the humanity, or the notion that a reporter is live at an event that's historic and
or
is
something
bigger
unexpected
than life.
Happens.
Yep, something unexpected. It's off script or off expectation.
Breaking into a program.
Right, breaking up the broadcast day and the regularity of when commercials come and when station identifications come and, you know, half-hour formats, you know, kind of breaking that all up was fairly new. It was only, you know, as I say, 18 months, a couple of years old. And the other is the ability of broadcasting to bring remote sites to, we might say, aggregate remote reportage into one studio or through the voice of one narrator. Now in New York, is this happening? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, now we cut to, you know, the ballroom in Chicago that's playing dance music. Well, remember that also got amped up, not just in an entertainment way, but also carrying news and carrying really important news, news about what's happening in Europe, live reports from Edward R. Murrow talking about, you know, failed treaties and troop movements in Germany, and all that stuff was happening. And would sometimes you'd get a flash or you'd get an interruption. And that's only a couple of years old as well.
We're talking 1938, which was the year in which we were supposed to have peace in our time, according to Neville Chamberlain, holding up the treaty with Nazi Germany, having given Czechoslovakia to the Germans, and plenty of paranoia in the air with good reason. I mean, this was founded on all kinds of insecurities. I mean, if you look at the front page of the New York Times the morning after the broadcast of War of the Worlds, right next to the War of the Worlds headline, talks about Polish Jews moving to safer places. And it was, I mean, it was in the news, it was in the air.
The sense of danger, the sense that our future is going to get dark, and it's going to get dark quickly, and I'm going to find out about it immediately, is new, and it's raw, and it's fresh for a listening audience. Another thing to think about is that the places where people listen to the radio are becoming more and more ubiquitous during this time. And some of that has to get is attributed to how many more automobiles there are. People are listening in the car. They're not just framing the radio listening experience by, you know, pulling out the knitting needles and sitting in the living room
at a specific time. They're not necessarily giving it full attention.
Yeah, great. Yes, great point. I'm actually driving and I'm flipping through, or I'm picking up a channel here or there. And that the notion that I can be, you know, driving in my neighborhood and immediately get a news bulletin about something that happened around the world is really compressing time and space in a way that was a very new experience for people in this period. We can think of it ourselves in terms of our digital age, where we get a lot of news immediately and we get, you know, pictures of something like the recent Boston bombing that are you know, going up on Twitter immediately, and we have a sense of, wow, that just happened. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we shouldn't be naive. People in 1938 were having that experience too. They were having the experience of reporting of a bombing happening in Europe, of the invasion of Abyssinia by
the Italians.
By the Italians, that was being broadcast live. So our sense that The ability of modern technology to compress time and compress space was really at an accelerate. It had accelerated to such a point that people were confused and didn't always know what they were listening to.
But wouldn't they have known that they were listening to Orson Welles' voice and that he had done Dracula and that, I mean, that the, you know, you would think that a figure as well known as Orson Welles would have been a bit recognizable.
Well, millions of them did recognize him, no doubt, and didn't get upset.
That's true. Is it true that the very beginning of the hour, when it was disclosed that this was a theatrical production, this was a radio drama, that occurred when many people were listening to another station?
I'm sure that that's true, but part of what we might explore even a little more, at least as a thought experiment, is the whole notion of changing and switching stations. And I would like for us to think about that as changing the frame when we're entering a thing. So if we've been listening to something else and we decide, oh, on CBS at this time, which happens every week, is Mercury Theater of the Air. Well, if you're home and you're, you know, have you just gone to the radio listing and you see that that's when it is, or you just know because it happens every week, the attitude you're bringing into it is very different than if you've been listening to something else, or if you just got in the car, or any number of things. And part of what I found interesting as I listened through the piece again, as I tried to imagine in my own mind's eye, what if I had entered this broadcast at this point? What if I had entered it at 4 minutes? Mm-hmm. What if I had entered it at 12 minutes? It's really easy to understand how people would be confused. And to get back to your question about whether Welles tried to do that or was deliberate about it, I think he was trying to make highly realistic radio drama. I think he was bringing a kind of, you know, verite to the task. But I can't imagine how he could have thought through all those permutations.
Yeah, it's hard to. That would be perhaps crediting or discrediting him too much to realize that, well, the Chase and Sanborn Hour has 30 million listeners, Mercury Theater has 6 million. Nelson Eddy is going to start singing at about 14 minutes in the Chase and Sanborn Hour. People are going to tune out, and they'll pick us up at the 14-minute mark. Seems unlikely, but that's what happened. He just, I suspect, did not plan it that way.
I think some of the confluences of events that happened around it were unique, were truly unique, were one-offs, were something that could
one
have
of those
been
perfect
planned.
Storms.
Perfect storm, yeah.
Well, let's dive into the adaptation itself, Yay. War of the Worlds. Tell us what we hear at the beginning and how that introduction helps set up the whole thing.
So the introduction clearly introduces the show as you would expect. It's Mercury Theater of the Air. It's their weekly broadcast time. We get it rolling. And then Welles is very clever about the setup, about bringing us into this world. And what he does is he imitates a lot of other popular broadcast conventions. We've just passed the hour, we've done our identification, and then we come up with a fictional broadcaster who's going to play an entertainment programming. And Welles sets us up by immediately going to another location. And I think that's one of the things that primes the audience to think that, oh, this broadcast I'm listening to, I'm talking within the fiction of the adaptation, that it's current and it's now, and that time and space will be compressed, that I can be sitting here in New Jersey listening live to a band playing in Chicago. And that's one of the ways he brings us into it, is with a really very mundane entertainment broadcast that, you know, is unremarkable in a lot of ways. And what a brilliant stroke. How unremarkable can it be that you kind of lull into it and think, oh, well, this isn't going to be challenging. You know, we'll just sit back and listen to some music.
From the Meridian Room in the Park Plaza Hotel in New York City, we bring you the music of Raymond Raquello and his orchestra. With a touch of the Spanish, Raymond Raquello leads off with La Capacita.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity. Professor Pearson of the observatory at Princeton confirms Farrell's observation and describes the phenomenon as, quote, like a jet of blue flame shot from a gun, unquote. We now return you to the music of Raymond Raquello, playing for you in the Meridian Room of the Park Plaza Hotel, situated in downtown New York.
So you'll notice, Emily, that what happens is he lulls us in, and he brings in this specter of a strange celestial phenomenon in the midst of, and it's very casual. Notice the tone. Oh, little news break in. There's been a flash of light in the area of Mars. How unusual. Well, we'll check with the observatory to see what happened. And then we go back to the music. So also notice that it doesn't just break in all at once. He doesn't just take us over all at once and say,
right,
you know, here
so
we are in the middle of this
release
world
of information.
Yeah, it doesn't say
effect.
Aliens from Mars. It kind of plants the seed that maybe there's a little something happening.
Yeah, funny observatories around the world have found this funny light, and how long will it take to travel to Earth if it indeed is even coming to Earth? And then Wells brings our focus to a particular place and to a particular time. That time is now. It's unfolding as we're sitting in our car or our living room, and it goes to a particular place. And he mentions a real place, Trenton, New Jersey, that it's somewhere near Trenton, New Jersey, which is a real place that everyone would recognize, whether or not you're from the area.
Also real.
And Grover's Mill is a close auditory to a real place, which I think was Groversville. So he changed it to Grover's Mill. And, you know, so it's not quite the same place, but if you're familiar with place names, it sounds believable and it's right there. And that's the first time we get a notion that our live broadcast unit will report from the site. So the fiction and the technique of bringing the audience's mind and attention to out of the studio to an actual historical event gets set up really within about 3 minutes.
And do we know from studies of the whole thing when people started to get alarmed?
Well, we know that calls started coming in, you know, to the New York police offices, and that's all in the New York Times account.
Right. I reread that Times account and saw it, you know, and they weren't getting into, like, at what time signature
right.
it was. However, we do have a sense – this is a little bit of a secondary source, but a very good documentary that's presented by Edward R. Murrow that was made in 1957 about the event and about all the about the event of the broadcast of the worlds and the panic that ensued. That, I mean, it's in that documentary, you get the sense that it's after about 10 or 15 minutes that it's really the people who are tuning in late, you know, who don't have the other frame, who don't have the frame of here's the mercury of the air,
right,
and maybe they're a little distracted or they've listened in their car. And that's when the calls start coming in and the switchboards, you know, start getting, you know, lighting up and warmed up and all that. And it makes sense that that would be the case. And when you think about the way the piece accelerates time, it really starts to push forward in terms of the storytelling, in terms of the way the narrative of Martians coming to Earth and the way we're able to report them to you compresses, and it starts to move really fast. So, if, you know, I mean, I, as I said, as I listened, I tried to imagine myself entering it at different points. And I think if you entered somewhere around 13 minutes where there's a kind of on-the-spot interview of, oh, we see a disc and it's hard and it's glowing light, you know, you would get sucked into it. Mm-hmm. Because the frame, the earlier framing is gone, and you just think you're listening to a live remote broadcast. So, you know, whether you believe that there was a Martian, you would think something was up. It had the tone of panic. It had the tone of, you need to know about this now, and I'm someone that is, you know, witnessing history vicariously through the radio.
And we'll find out a little bit, too, about whether this broadcast actually prescribed behavior response on the part of its listeners. When we return in a moment, this is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Tim Troy, who's filling us in about one of the most famous of all broadcast events, an event of October 30th, 1938, the broadcast of the War of the Worlds. And it was a time in radio, just in anything from commercials to presentation of news, when authority. It was all about authority. I mean, you had the voice of God narration. You mm-hmm. had commercials that tell you what to get and when to get it and where to get it. How does authority play into this?
My sense is that for this particular piece, this new technology, this ability to bring eyewitness accounts from an historical event that people knew were real, that the sense of if I can at least provisionally meld both authenticity and authority at the same time, that, you know, only people who get behind the mic are authoritative. We only let people hear who are telling you the truth, that there's an unseen editor happening so that we only will broadcast information that we can verify. And we do that either through a lot of research, or another way we can do it is that live narration, because we can do this thing that couldn't be done even a few years prior to that. And I think part of what Wells does is he garners, or he aggregates different kinds of authority to help us experience in our fantasy, if we know that this is an adaptation and we're hip to all that, or if we don't know that, our gullibility by the way he gathers different authority figures around it. So you have
authority equals credibility.
Authority mm-hmm. equals credibility, yeah. And one of the main characters in the War of the Worlds is this scientist, this professor, Professor Pearson, who happens to be played by Wells himself. So, you know, you have like his great voice. But the character of Pearson is also narrating the event at the time. So you have a sense that someone who would know what they're talking about, like, okay, we've never had a meteorite come from Mars, or we've never had a spaceship come from Mars. But if one did come from Mars, the guy you'd want on the scene is this expert who knows everything else about the universe and would be able to comment authoritatively, at least know what he was seeing.
And he comes across as initially doubtful or skeptical or something. In other words, this isn't someone who comes into the event and immediately jumps to the conclusion.
Yes, he's got a scientific, a dispassionate reserve. You know, mm-hmm. he's thinking, oh, this isn't, you know, well, let's gather some evidence before we make a conclusion. And he certainly does that. Notice how he also does that in the context of the radio drama live with first-person reportage. So we get the notion, the layers of authority, the expert, the turning over the broadcast airwaves to the militia, right, to the people who protect us. We also get a point of view that's not restricted to this area of New Jersey. We've had earlier, we had, oh, there's a report from an observatory somewhere else in the country that said this happened. Oh, we're getting other reports from around the world. They're triangulating on it. So they're bringing this, the sense of science, scientific authority, military authority, governmental authority. He's bringing that all to bear on this particular task.
Now, one of the things he does when you talk about government authority, I gather, was a little controversial for CBS because Wells, and we should pause here to credit the actual scriptwriter, Howard Koch.
Yes.
Who, of course, was working very closely with Wells. But Wells wanted this Secretary of the Interior, I believe it was, to sound like FDR. And CBS, who caught wind of it, I guess, just ahead of time, said, No, don't do that. And then Wells said to Kenny Delmar, the guy who did the thing, do it.
Yeah.
Just do it anyway.
Do it
and
anyway.
And it sounds like this.
At this time, we take you to Washington for a special broadcast on the national emergency. The Secretary of the Interior.
Citizens of the nation, I shall not try to conceal the gravity of the situation that confronts the country, nor the concern of your government in protecting the lives and property of its people. However, I wish to impress upon you, private citizens and public officials, all of you, the urgent need of calm and resourceful action. Fortunately, this formidable enemy is still confined to a comparatively small area, and we may place our faith in the military forces to keep them there. In the meantime, placing our faith in God, we must continue the performance of our duties, each and every one of us, so that we may confront this destructive adversary with a nation united, courageous, and consecrated to the preservation of human supremacy on this earth. I thank you.
So we have a government figure, we have a commander that comes in, we've got this professor. What did Wells do as an actor with the portrayal of Professor Pearson to kind of pick up on the popular notion of somebody who's professorial?
Wells has a commanding voice and a very particular kind of diction that sounds very well educated. It's crystalline clarity. You never have any doubt what he's saying. And I think he commanded the airwaves in a way through a lot of experience. For instance, one of the live broadcast narrative that Pearson takes on is it's kind of after the capsule opens and there's been some chaos, and they shift to a different microphone, and you're getting a sense that he's actually calling in. So it sounds like the sound of a microphone, a 1930s era telephone microphone that's highly compressed. And through that, I notice when I listen to it is that even then he slows down a little bit. He has a sense that this sounds different, that I need to be calm. I need to be calmer than everything around me. And I need to command your attention in a way that that befits this crisis, within the narrative of the piece. Another thing that I notice about that moment as well is that it is the exact same effect that Orson Welles used for many years as the voice of the Shadow, a long-running series. It's kind of a detective series.
And it just left it a couple of weeks before this broadcast.
Just a couple of weeks before. Now, I bring that up because part of the way that the voice of the Shadow works within the show, The Shadow, is that it brings a very vivid image in your mind of a presence that's not corporal, that's just a voice that's omnipresent, that can see what's really going on and can fix things.
Well, he has the gift of invisibility, so he literally is lacking substance for the bad guys.
For the bad guys, and it's always in the service of the good people. So, knowing something about a variety of radio dramas in that period and trying to put my mind into a listener, that voice is very specific. It is unmistakable. So, on the one hand, I think, well, how did you not know it was Orson Welles? I mean, most people would have heard Orson Welles doing The Shadow. But when I think, when I'm a little more generous, I'm thinking about kind of the confusion of tuning in at that time, it carries this notion of strength, of invincibility, of authority, of knowing things that the average person couldn't know. Mm-hmm. It's a power to see what's really there and to show you things that you can't see. So I think Wells does that beautifully. And then, of course, the whole last part, you know, after the crisis, the last 15 minutes of the broadcast are really, it's not verite anymore. It's a kind of inner monologue about this is how it went. And
it's quite theatrical, yeah, it's quite obviously. So the other thing about Wells, though, and Kenny Delmar, was that just a couple of years before this, they'd both been involved with The March of Time, mm-hmm. which is sort of a newsreel, a very historical or newsy presentation of things in an authoritative voice. And so if you maybe didn't hear The Shadow, but you heard The March of Time, and you kind of equated these voices with authority and the real, the facts. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think on this topic of authority is that let's also remember that at least in American broadcasting, there are certain conventions that listeners get used to. They get used to shows changing over at the hour or the half hour. They get used to what time a station identification comes in. And this has been true and it was true at that time as well. I've done some research, as you both may know, on British radio drama. And in fact, you know, through the BBC, they don't have those conventions. So you'll listen to radio dramas and sometimes they're 32 minutes and sometimes they're 48 minutes. And they don't have those conventions. But American broadcasting always did. So if you get used to listening to The March of Time, you get used to a certain convention in your ear, in a way it's presented that has a kind of authority. And when you take that and borrow those conventions to the service of a fictional work, you're carrying that sense of authority and that sense of believability with you. And he knew that. I mean, he certainly knew that because he and the writer, you know, went through the motions of updating it. It's not just an adaptation like we'll put voices in now. He's really putting it in a different time and place that seems very current. Incredible.
And what does he do in terms of other sound effects? You mentioned that there's this different kind of microphone to make it sound as if it's being called in. What mm-hmm. are some of the creative uses of sound?
Two come to mind right away. When we're on location, they do a great job, even though it's being produced in the studio, of reproducing the sound of a microphone getting passed between people out in a non-studio setting. So as somebody approaches the microphone, you get this, you know, a little bit of a distant sound, and then I'm up next to the microphone, and here I am giving you my, you know, what I just saw, you know, around the bend. So they reproduce that technique really well to great effect. And these, you know, these people in the studio were pros. They knew what the sound was that they were looking for. Another one that I'm especially fond of is there's a series of reports, like flash reports that have just come in from the telex or something, where some news broadcaster is in a studio somewhere gathering all these reports, and he's going through one by one, you know, all the events that are happening in the region. And he uses the technique of disfluency beautifully. He'll start and then stop and then comment, oh my gosh, you know, I just got something else in. He's not talking straight through a text. We get a sense of discovery of new information and how it's building and snowballing. And there's a kind of accelerando that works its way all the way through that 2 minutes. That's really very gripping. And when you think about it happening in the studio, you have an actor. These were pros. These were people who were extremely fluent, you know, verbally fluent and knew how to use a microphone. I always like to imagine that actor acting like he's disfluent mm-hmm. and doing it beautifully.
Bulletins too numerous to read are piling up in the studio here. We're informed that the central portion of New Jersey is blacked out from radio communication due to the effect of the heat ray upon power lines and electrical equipment. Here is a bulletin from Basking Ridge, New Jersey. Coon hunters have stumbled on a second cylinder similar to the first, embedded in the great swamp 20 miles south of Morristown. Army field pieces are proceeding from Newark to blow up the second invading unit before the cylinder can be opened and the fighting machine rigged. They are taking up a position in the foothills of Watchung Mountains. Another bulletin from Langham Field, Virginia. Scouting planes report enemy machines, now three in number, increasing speed northward, kicking over houses and trees in their evident haste to form a conjunction with their allies south of Morristown. Machines also sighted by telephone operator east of Middlesex, within 10 miles of Plainfield. Here's a bulletin from Winston Field, Long Island. A fleet of army bombers carrying heavy explosive flying north in pursuit of enemy. Scouting planes act as guides. They keep the speeding enemy in sight. Just a moment, please, ladies and gentlemen.
Another advantage, disadvantage of the Mercury Theater broadcast of War of the Worlds is that it didn't have a sponsor. I mean, this was a high culture show. It's almost hard to believe today.
Yeah.
But compared again to the Chase and Sanborn Hour that was on opposite it, it was high culture and didn't have a sponsor, therefore didn't have to have commercial breaks.
Right. That goes back to some of the techniques or the conventions of broadcasting that an audience would have been used to. So if you're listening to commercial broadcast, you know that there's going to be a station identification. You'll feel it, even if you're not looking at your watch. You know it's going to happen
around
20 minutes.
We now conclude Act 1. Of...
Yes, or there would be that. Now conclude Act 1. We'll hear from our sponsors. There's an ad. Well, this is a show without a sponsor, so they can keep going. They don't need to take that 20-minute station identification or commercial break. But an audience is still used to that time. That, and even in other anthology broadcasts, they would still do the break. They would write to an act, and they even would use the theatrical term of "That's the end of Act One of this broad of the story." And when we return, even if you didn't put an ad in there, you would still have some identification of the network, some identification of the show itself. This show runs till 40 minutes before there's a break. So there is no space. If you get caught up, you know, in that fictional imaginary mm-hmm. person who tuned in at 14 minutes, say, this is sustaining. And this is outside of the habit, outside of the expectation of identification that this is Mercury Theater of the Year. Sure, they said it mm-hmm. at the beginning. Maybe you looked at your listing and knew it was happening at 8 o'clock. But if you're in your car, or you just got done washing the dishes, this story is just moving forward. It's pushing forward like breaking news, and there is no relief.
Right. So it would have seemed much more serious than if they had taken the time to go to a commercial. What did they do to make it seem as if they were sort of scrambling on the air to get it right so that it didn't sound polished? Or, you know, you mentioned the sort of disfluency that you know, sort of starting and stopping. What else did they do so that it would seem as if this hadn't been pre-planned?
Well, there's another great example within the broadcast where the on-the-spot reporter is talking about, has just described the Martians who've come out of the sphere.
And this is so reminiscent of Herb Morrison and the Hindenburg, too.
Yeah, it's right there. They're describing as they're seeing it, and they're described as having skin like wet leather. And a couple moments later, the Earthlings, the army raises a white flag as if, you know, Martians would understand that a white flag is surrender. But, you know, I mean, that's how the story goes. But in our mind's eye, that's what's going on. And then there the reporting builds up to a crescendo until you get a sense of the feed being cut, the live feed, that there's been some sort of disaster where the person at the other end of the mic and the equipment that they're using has blown up. Or
Well, he mentions that the truce flag bearers have been incinerated.
Yes.
So the Martians apparently didn't get the message or didn't care.
They didn't. They don't understand the conventions of white flags, and they're going to use their heat ray anyway. So in the moment, you get this scream and then silence.
And that is a tricky thing in radio. How long can you go silent before you have worked against yourself?
Right. So an audience at the time, I think, you know, Wells is, as a radio drama director, you're a kind of conductor. You're manipulating time. And I think Wells takes that silence just excruciatingly long. It's about 6 seconds. 6 seconds in broadcast time is a long period of time. On the other hand, a good storyteller who sets it up that there's a heat ray or there's something that's blowing up these, you know, your fellow citizens, you need to breathe after something like that. So the piece itself has breath at moments. And it's a long period of time. It's probably one of the rare times where you can get along with six seconds of silence and stay with the broadcast.
Well, let's see what that's like. Let's experience it ourselves, the setup and then the 6 seconds of silence and then coming in after it.
Ladies and gentlemen, am I on? Ladies and gentlemen, here I am, back of a stone wall that adjoins Mr. Wilmer's garden. From here, I get a sweep of the whole scene. I'll give you every detail as long as I can talk and as long as I can see. More state police have arrived. They're drawing up a cordon in front of the pit. About 30 of them. No need to push the crowd back now. They're willing to keep their distance. The captain's conferring with someone. Can't quite see who. Oh, yes, I believe it's Professor Pearson. Yes, it is. Now they've parted, and the professor moves around one side. studying the object while the captain and two policemen advanced with something in their hands. I can see it now. It's a white handkerchief tied to a pole. Flag of truce. If those creatures know what that means, what anything means. Wait a minute. Something's happening. A humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Now the whole field's caught up by the woods, as far as the gas tanks of the automobiles are spreading everywhere. It's coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
Immediately after that 6 seconds of silence, you imagine an audience holding their breath or maybe just exhaling or something like that.
Dropping their knitting.
Yeah, dropping their knitting. Suddenly we get a voice back. We get some sort of control booth voice that understands that some sort of tragedy has happened in New Jersey. We immediately go to a report from San Diego. So in our mind's eye, geographically, 3,000 miles away, a report from San Diego that 40 people have died, that this invasion is actually transcontinental and has stretched out beyond the particular place we were just paying attention to.
What a shock. More on War of the Worlds when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, we have a special statement from Mr. Harry McDonald, Vice President in charge of operations.
We have received a request from the State Militia of Trenton to place at their disposal our entire broadcasting facilities. In view of the gravity of the situation, and believing that radio has a responsibility to serve in the public interest at all times, we are turning over our facilities to the State Militia at Trenton.
We take you now to the field headquarters of the state militia near Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
That's from the middle of the radio adaptation of War of the Worlds, and audiences of the time in 1938 might have thought the airwaves had just been turned over to the military. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland and our guest Tim Troy, as we are talking about the famous 1938 radio show Panic after broadcast of War of the Worlds. At this point, Tim, when audiences think that the station they're listening to, or at least part of the audience that doesn't know it's a theater production, thinks that the airwaves have been taken over, what is it that now makes us look back and almost laugh at the gullibility? You know, what is it that made it so that people thought that was really happening?
In the narrative itself, after this disaster, one of which we just listened to, where they break over to San Diego and then we get some more multi-point reporting, there is a line that says, or the narrator says, we now turn over our broadcast to the militia, to the army. And suddenly the medium of radio takes on the actuality of a radio broadcast itself as part of the story, but a radio broadcast that would normally be hidden to us. So on the one hand, it's a little gullible to think I'm suddenly listening on a different channel, like they're broadcast at different hertz, but that somehow through the magic of this medium that we're still learning about, if you're in 1938, we have a window into that which we don't usually see, that this disaster is so prevalent, the crisis is so urgent that it's okay right now if we actually listen to what's happening inside the cockpit of a bomber. That's what you think you're listening to. So we can think, oh, you know, come on, how could you believe that? But the radio play takes you there in a really brilliant way.
So what they're doing is actually they're kind of stripping away these layers separating you from the event, because you start out with you have radio announcer and he's kind of your intermediate.
Mm-hmm.
And he will then bring in these people who are one notch closer to it. And you get reports that way. But here, you don't have your radio announcer, you don't have your on-site reporters, you have, this is just almost like raw sound that you're getting. You are now face-to-face with the situation.
Raw sound, no editor, no one explaining it to you. Earlier, there had been an example of the soldiers using artillery terms because they were going to try to blow it up. So you got a little piece of that, and it's another brilliant thing, right? You got a little bit of that early on, so you think, oh, you know, I can have access to that. Then when the airways are taken over by the Army, you really feel like you're not only an eyewitness, but you're not even waiting for a reporter to tell you. You know, it's the equivalent of the cameras in the cockpit itself, but it's the microphone that's in the cockpit. And you know what? We don't even need a microphone anymore because this is broadcast right. Anyway, and we're just pulling it in through the radio, the civilian radio that's, you know, in my car or in my living room is listening to the very thing that's happening, you know, at 5,000 feet in a bomber. And that's responding to this crisis that's happening all around me. It sounds crazy to us, or we would understand that wouldn't be possible. But when you think of the brilliance of the medium, that you don't have to change your medium. The radio that you're listening to anyway is the same device that would pick up these broadcasts, and it becomes very believable.
And would people of the time, the way we're used to sometimes something coming over a radio and telling us that there's a tornado, you know, this sort of emergency broadcast, would they have at all been familiar with the fact that the radio could be used to get out important alerts?
My understanding is that there was a kind of hierarchy of what could get interrupted, and that a flash, isn't that right? Isn't that the word? The flash report was the one that can, like, interrupt anything. And then there was, you know, other lower levels of, but certainly
but the sponsor had control over all of that, and whether you had to, you had to get permission, even for World War II bulletins, the sponsor called the shots on whether they get on the air or not.
Because the sponsor, in a way, owned that airtime.
That's right. Yeah. Of course, not in the case with the Mercury Theater. No sponsor.
No sponsor. Yeah, those rules go.
Orson
right.
Welles without his leash.
Yeah.
And what does Orson Welles do when you approach the part of the program that has to do with the destruction of New York?
Cleverly, we find a way, you know, the engineers in the background who we don't see, take us off of the military broadcast and bring us back onto the civilian news broadcast and find a way to put the microphone into the eyewitness report of a reporter. And we get a kind of rooftop reportage of the destruction of New York City. And it's fascinating and it's wonderful. Now, when you listen back to it, you know, the cynical, critical ear can say, where in goodness sakes could this guy possibly be standing that he would see all of this if you know anything about the topography of New York? On the other hand, one can imagine, at least in your imagination, in the fantasy that Welles is so brilliantly crafting for us, a place where you could conceivably, plausibly, under these extraordinary circumstances, see what he's describing, including huge monsters wading the Hudson as if it's a pond or a stream, which gives you a wonderful sense of scale. And describing particular places that people would be familiar with, even, you know, whether they had been there themselves, but they've seen pictures of it. He goes across site by site throughout Manhattan of buildings toppling, of people scattering, of being crushed underfoot. The other interesting thing to me is that the destructive power of the Martians, you know, they have heat beams, which are really kind of cool and have been, like, fascinating for, you know, a lot of sci-fi movies of a later period would do the heat beam. I always think of microwave ovens. It's like, wow, that's a huge microwave. But these beings were also huge, and steel or some kind of metal.
Their devices, yeah, those tripods or whatever they were.
Yeah.
Yes, that these leathery, slimy things rode in.
And they had some kind of internal, like, apparatus that was heavy and strong and could, you know, the soft flesh of humanity was no, it was, it was not going
to
stop them.
Stopped.
Right. So this reporter is on a rooftop describing the destruction of Manhattan. And it's a kind of presage of what will, from what we know, the famous broadcast of Murrow describing the Blitz in London from rooftops a couple of years later. But there, I mean, some of that we get in retrospect, but there is a kind of verite, there's a technique involved that's really very compelling. And What happens at the end of that sequence when he describes, as I said, the wading through the Hudson and, you know, the humanity falling and buildings falling, is that the narrator, for a second time, we had that with the silence earlier, but a narrator clearly gets killed, gets cut off. Something happens where a heat ray gets him. But interestingly, this time, it doesn't cut off the broadcast. So it's a similar technique to what we heard earlier, but in many ways, you know, it's actually a more eerie technique because we get the sounds of the city sans humanity. And that section goes on for a remarkably long time as well. It's quite interesting and quite brilliant. It's 24 seconds of a soundscape, ironically, of an empty city without the sound of people alive in it. It's very eerie. It reminds me a lot of Beckett, by the way, which I know is also like too early, but this sense of modernity of humanity absent from a world in which we ourselves built.
Our army is wiped out. Artillery, air force, everything wiped out. This may be the last broadcast. We'll stay here to the end.
You know, listening to this sense of New York being destroyed and all that reminds me of this sort of ironic memory I have, really, of I was in a car listening to the radio when 9/11 happened. And for a moment, I thought it was fiction, that I was listening to a radio drama. And it took a little while to realize, oh, that's an actual news report. But I think this blurring between fiction and fact is something that, you know, the War of the Worlds broadcast certainly handled more brilliantly than just about anything we know of. What for you would be the sort of, I guess, the lessons from this broadcast and its history, or the sort of, you know, the take-home message of all this?
I think, to me, it's a great question. I think, to me, it's just a kind of healthy respect for the power of a medium, especially of a broadcast medium that goes from a single point out generally, rather than a one-to-one communication where, you know, the receiver and the, you know, the sender and the receiver are both identified in a closed loop. And I think it's humbling also to think about the inability of people new to a broadcast medium to discriminate truth from fiction, you know?
Well, the power of art, perhaps?
Well, thank you very much. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the power of a compelling, certainly the power of a compelling narrative in the hands of, you know, a really technically astute, not only Wells, but the whole Mercury Theater team that, you know, knew how to control narrative and control time.
You think it could be done today?
I don't know. Are we more hip? Are we more naive? I think the whole issue of the layering the whole demands of the visual medium on top of it, you know, one can certainly create a great melodrama that might tell us the story of getting sucked. I don't know. It's hard.
We file for hoaxes still.
We certainly have our hoaxes still. We have, we don't know the credibility anymore of things on the internet. I mean, we've kind of gone the other way in that authority issue where not everything's
lost,
not edited anymore.
We've lost the authority, haven't we?
Yeah.
And with it, the credibility.
Yeah.
Well, it's fascinating to speculate. We hope that nothing like that happens again, but it was a fascinating confluence of events and technologies in 1938. Tim Troy, thanks for filling us in about the War of the Worlds.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.